The Guardian.
Are you an aspiring journalist or writer? The Guardian International Development Journalism Competition is your chance to win an assignment to Africa, Asia, or South America. You'll write for The Guardian about the global development issues that face the area you visit. All you need to do is submit a short essay on one of the 12 diverse themes. You can find all the information you need at guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. Enter now to win the work experience of a lifetime. Visit guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. The deadline is midnight on Sunday the 12th of May. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. After last week's bruising at the local election, the government lays out its plans for the year ahead at the state opening of Parliament. What does the Queen's speech say about coalition priorities? And with immigration crackdowns and tougher prison policy rising up the agenda, is the government being dragged to the right by UKIP? We'll look at how likely the new bills are to pass through the Commons and remind ourselves which ones have been quietly abandoned. Also this week, a historic election in Pakistan as the country prepares for its first ever democratic change of government. We'll hear from the writer and novelist Camilla Shamsi in Karachi. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Martin Kettle and Anne Perkins. A warm welcome to you both. Getting the barnacles off the boat. Such is the strategy from David Cameron's new no-nonsense campaign director, Lynton Crosby. It roughly translates as, focus on clear messages and ditch everything that's too difficult or unpopular. With that in mind, the government has laid out its legislative programme this week. And with the ink dry on the vellum, what have we learnt about the government's direction of travel?
Stalled, I'd say. Very uncertain. This Queen's speech made me think a little bit of those magazine conferences where the first question is, what's the strapline on the front of the magazine going to be? This was a Queen's speech where they thought of the headlines and then they packed in the policy behind them. And then policy was severely constrained by what could be agreed with their coalition partners. And the answer to that was not very much. And there were a few areas of general and widespread concern, of which the most obvious is immigration, on which they concentrated. And otherwise, the scraping the barnacles clearing the decks, which I think was the Prime Minister's own expression, is really a euphemism for not really having very much more to do.
Well, OK, well, let's just pause there, because I'm joined now by our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis, who can give us some of the lowdown of what the bits and pieces on the Home Affairs front actually meant. Alan, first of all, then, there's a lot about prisons and immigrations, but on prisons, is this a big deal?
Well, if the overall impression of the rest of the Queen's speech was of drift in the coalition, we finally saw, I think, a bit of Thatcherite-style red meat from Chris Grayling, who has come up with very ambitious proposals to ensure that every prisoner leaving jail gets a minimum of 12 months supervision and rehabilitation on release, which is widely welcomed by everybody. The Thatcherite bit comes in on how he intends to deliver it. Unfortunately, having no money to provide these services in the public sector, he's decided to dismantle the public probation service and invite private companies like G4S and Serco, together with the voluntary sector and charities, to bid to overtake this work. A strategy document in which he published on Thursday morning detailed that in terms of proportion work between the two sectors, what would be left, the public probation service will be left supervising just 12% of offenders who are the most high risk and public protection work, with the other 88% being carried out the work delivered by partnerships of private security companies and charities and voluntary organisations to deal with drug treatment and so on.
So it sounds like a very dramatic privatisation. You know, if you think of health or something, you talk about 10 or 15% private round the edge. This sounds quite a dramatic one. On the other hand, isn't the record of the Prisons and Probation Service in reducing reoffending been sufficiently dismal that he's justified in trying some shock therapy?
Well, in those sentences, those prisoners who have post-release supervision now, i.e. all those prisoners who serve more than 12 months, there's quite as much lower rates of reoffending, and that's been carried out by the Public Probation Service over many years. The one gap in the market, if you like, has been short sentence prisoners who serve less than 12 months, and they have always walked out of the prison gate door with just a £46 discharge grant in their pocket and no further contact with the prison or probation service. And David Blunkett, for example, recognised this 10 years ago when he proposed a sentence of custody plus, put on the statute book, legislated for, never implemented, was left on the shelf until probation resources would allow. Well, we finally got to the day where they finally given up and said, OK, we're never going to have the probation resources publicly to do this. Instead, we're going to bring in private capital, private providers, and try and bring the market to bear on the solution.
So do you think there's a real risk that some real experience, some really valuable know-how is going to be lost in this process?
Well, Ken Clark started this process, his rehabilitation revolution. He started pilot schemes for it in Peterborough and Doncaster. The government's coalition government under Ken Clark wanted to wait and see the result of those pilots, so there weren't risks with public safety carried out in this. Chris Cranian's come in, man in a hurry, no time to waste. Whatever the 100-day or whatever it was it took to set up the work programme, the results we now see, he's intent on getting this major programme. These contracts are worth between $5 billion and $20 billion over 10 years in place and up and running by the time of the general election. Immensely ambitious and a lot of concern about the scale and pace.
The other sort of big Home Affairs ticket in the Queen's speech was immigration. They clearly wanted that to be the headline. The detail looked a bit bitty, didn't it? I mean, in that there was stuff about public services, there was stuff about what the appeals can do in
the detail was completely absent. This was no more than a holding statement by Theresa May and David Cameron on immigration. The only two specific proposals in the... I mean, ministers have been discussing for 6 months now, meeting regularly, how to try and deny access of new migrants to public services, limit them, stop abuse and fraud. They've come up with two specific proposals in this legislative package. One, a restatement to the judges about how they must consider the national interest when they're considering whether or not to deport foreign national prisoners who have family in Britain. And secondly, the only specific thing in the Queen's speech was a proposal that private landlords should check the immigration status of their tenants without giving any indication of how that might work. All the rest, a mere aspiration, an idea that migrants should in some way pay a contribution to NHS services. No detail about how it's going to happen. I don't think we'll see a bill, an immigration bill, for several months, if not until the autumn. I think the coalition is deadlocked on this at the moment and is a long way away from actually producing serious legislation.
Not doing very much. Well, sometimes, Martin, in the past, we've ticked governments off if it's our place to do that for being hyperactive, doing too many things at once. Might be rather shrewd of Cameron to decide to do a bit less this year then?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think that, you know, that becomes quite a good explanation and justification for this. But I think Anne is right that there are a whole number of things that the government can't do, can't agree on, because it's a coalition, that the different wings would quite like to do. And basically, those have been put to one side.
I
think Europe is the most obvious thing from the Tory point of view. That's the thing that the Tory backbenches and the Tory press are longing to do, is to bring Europe to a head, and also in the same European context to make some big gesture about the Human Rights Act. But those are two things which the Liberal Democrats are absolutely never going to agree to, and that's why they aren't in the Queen's speech and why Cameron, you know, wasn't able to play to that gallery in the Queen's speech, which is why it felt to the Tories as though it was a rather light speech. On the other hand, you know, you look at the list of bills and there are some pretty big ticket items, both politically and financially, there. I mean, the HS2 railway bill is one of those. Pensions reform is normally a pretty serious item. Social care, these are big subjects. And so, you know, it's not that they're going to have nothing to talk about. It's just that they're not going to have quite enough to talk about, because basically British politics is just waiting to see whether the economy picks up or not.
Yes, because they kept talking, the Queen kept talking about growth and competitiveness and these kind of words that you'd think she probably doesn't use at the table at Windsor Castle. But really, passing laws, Anne, isn't going to make much odds about that, is it?
It's not, is it? And in that context, it's the, you know, the big announcement comes next month with the chance to spending plans. But listening to Martin, actually, they are big ticket items, and in a way, there should be a bonus from this apparent period of where the coalition as a project is becalmed, where things that I think we described as administrative more than political in our leader this morning actually are really important things that need to be done in a spirit of non-partisanship. And if we can make progress on, for example, pension reform, I mean, that in a way, that would be a more significant achievement than almost anything else that the coalition might claim.
I don't think one should be too dismissive about the Queen's speech in that sense. I think we should just try to identify what it is going to do, what it isn't going to do, and what it adds up to politically, which I suspect, given the absolute sort of overarching nature of the economic problems which have haunted this whole Parliament and will haunt the rest of it, it's not going to add up to a whole lot. I mean, you know, it's very impressionistic, but I got an email from a good, experienced Labour person this morning just saying, you know, I think a lot of people think that what the coalition is doing is, you know, difficult but right, and this is the problem that Labour will face in attacking the coalition. Of course these are hard times, but, you know, what is Labour's strategy for overcoming it? That's one of the... You know, that's the oppositional issue for the next 2 years. I mean, I think people still like coalitions in principle. They still, in the sense that they like politicians not being too hyperactive and trying to work together if they can. So, to that extent, the coalition, of 2000, what gave the coalition popularity in 2010, shortly after it was formed, still exists to a certain degree. But, one shouldn't exaggerate it. I mean, look at the latest YouGov poll this morning. I was just checking before I came here. You know, Tories after the Queen's speech are on 27. And the Lib Dems are on 11. You know, that is not good for the coalition.
It also occurs to me, actually, and this is kind of in a broader point about coalition, is that we still haven't really kind of caught up with the idea of coalition in the way we talk about government and politics, and that we look to the Queen's speech very much as a kind of government branding exercise, and we expect to hear, blue in tooth and claw policies enunciated, articulated from the throne. And when we get something less than that, we are in some way disappointed and dissatisfied.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like the thing that's really happened is, I mean, Nick Clegg had this word, didn't he? Dreadful word, transactional, for how the coalition was going to work after he'd not got the AV referendum, not got Lords reform and the rest of it. But it did feel like that, this Queen's speech, didn't it? I mean, the Liberal Democrats can be quite justifiably pleased, I guess, with this pet project they've got on pensions, getting that as far as it did. The Tories will like the immigration stuff and some of the prison stuff maybe that Alan Travis was talking about. What it doesn't do is knit together as a story or narrative in the jargon,
isn't it? Or else does Cameron felt in some way inhibited from trying to tell the story because of the constraints of coalition. I mean, it's interesting what wasn't in there. I mean, the fact that he didn't revisit same-sex marriage, for example, you know, which is the thing that his, you know, the people who voted UKIP in the local elections last week most viscerally hate. I don't believe he's going to go back on it, but I can see he didn't want to brag about it.
Maybe didn't want the Queen to be talking about it.
Perhaps he thought she wouldn't
not
be
in
able
front
to
of the
talk
Queen.
About it.
Be as gay as you like, but not in front of the Queen, please.
Queen's notoriously, or sort of famously, surrounded by gay courtiers.
Oh, right. Martin, what about, we said there's not a big story here, but is there a kind of little lurch rightward despite Europe and things not being on the menu? Other things like plain packs for cigarettes have bitten the dust as well, which might Liberal Democrats side of the coalition might have quite liked.
Yes, well, I think there is a pretty clear case which we need to investigate more, which really suggests that the government has been pushed off what it was going to do on alcohol pricing and on the packaging of cigarettes by special interests and lobbies about which Cameron has always been very dismissive in the past and said they were the great scandal that was waiting to happen. You know, prima facie, you know, without looking into all the detail, it looks to me as though the special interests have notched up a couple of big victories there, possibly courtesy of Linton Crosby. I think the it comes back to the main headline that the government wanted, that certainly the Tory part of the government wanted, and I think the Liberal Democrats were prepared to go along with it, out of this Queen's speech was an immigration headline. That was the message they were trying to put over, and I think they will be pretty pleased that they managed to achieve that. That was the headline. I mean, what it actually will mean in practice when this bill goes through Parliament and some of its difficulties get teased out is another matter. But very clearly, although the UKIP voters don't like gay marriage, I would suspect they don't like immigrants even more. And there is a wide public concern about immigration, not always very coherently based on the facts, but it is, there is clearly a large amount of immigration. The immigration system is badly administered, and people are nervous about that because we're in a difficult economic set of circumstances, and people do not like the feeling that immigrants are getting something which they're not able to get themselves, if that is indeed the case.
Although, as Alan Travis was saying, and a lot of the detail of this might not happen. I mean, we've still got 2 years of this Parliament left. We're still mid-term, but it did feel a bit like, we're really talking about what's in manifestos and what governments can say they're doing rather than what they're able to show voters they have done by 2015 already. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think inevitably you just kind of reach that watershed, you kind of balance at the top and then you start going down the other side of a Parliament. I think the immigration thing is starting to throw up some really, really interesting administrative questions, but ones that will become increasingly important. And I keep coming back to, Tony Blair's absolute conviction that we had to have a system of ID cards, which, we all still kind of intuitively, instinctively, deeply dislike. But if the country really thinks that some form of certified entitlement is the only way to, or is a desirable way to go, I don't see how you can do it without some form of ID card.
Yes, it will be interesting to see whether Labour returns to this this policy as the election gets nearer, because Cameron made very clear to David Blunkett in the House yesterday that he wasn't going to go down that route. The Liberal Democrats pretty clearly aren't going to go down that route either. So you may get a situation in which Labour campaigns puts something along these lines in its manifesto, which is very consistent with the whole sort of blue Labour ideology, which Ed Miliband is interested in, or some of his advisors are interested in. And you could well imagine, there being a coalition between Labour and the Liberal Democrats formed in 2015, in which they had to agree to drop it. And so we may find that we're just going to go around in circles on this question.
How do you think it will look this time next year? We've still got another Queen's speech to go, haven't we? And everything we're saying is saying there's an awful lot of constraints already. Can you imagine the spending review is going to do more damage to everyone next month. Can you imagine them putting together any sort of programme in 12 months' time?
I think it's going to be very difficult. I mean, I think that basically what's happened this year is what I think that when they looked over the Parliament from 2010 and looked ahead to 2015 over the whole arc of the 5 years in which they were been planning to be in government, they did not intend to get to this point in 2013. I think we're really having 2014 a year early. And that is troublesome, I think, for the coalition. It will create a lot of political management pressures, because basically each of the two parties is increasingly going its own way. And that's very striking now. I mean, Liberal Democrats, whom I talk to, say they are already trying to work out things that they can be saying now which will be attractive to Labour on a range of things.
It was very interesting.
So that is happening in 2013, with 2 years to go to the election. One could imagine it beginning to happen in a year or 15 months' time, as the election absolutely is front and centre of all calculations. But to have them saying it 2 years out, it's like planning to end a marriage, not that I have any experience of this, 2 years in advance. It seems a really odd thing to be doing, to be calculating quite so far in advance. And it seems to me that something's going to have to give there.
I mean, I was at Nick Clegg's positioning on the childcare changes. I mean, you know, to let that, to release that, overnight, when it's something that's been under discussion for months.
It's in January we had this statement, didn't we? That
yes.
We're going to let nannies have, not nannies, childminders have more children.
You have more children, exactly. And to come out the morning after the Queen's speech seems as careful a piece of management.
Yes, there are other things in the pipeline. Yeah. If the conversations I've had are...
you do think, don't you, as you look back, that the thing, the big, progressive things in last year's Queen's speech, the House of Lords reform, and they had the thing about modernising the monarchy as well, that's all dropped away. But that Lords reform, Anne, in particular, seems to have been a moment for Clegg where he sort of decided, almost blasted him back into equidistance between the parties, didn't
it? Yeah, yeah. I've just thought of the one thing, two thoughts come to mind. One, I wonder why they didn't go back to the green agenda, which is where they perhaps could have done something much more constructive. Actually, I see that we've got a good story running this morning about the Green Bank expanding its borrowing and investment. The other thing that I think has been quite interesting this week, if I dare ask a question rather than try to answer one, is Adonis's book about the formation of the coalition and what that tells us about how it might be done next time. Have you been surprised about what you've read about how Clegg was definitely, wanting to draw out the process, wanting to talk harder, further, longer?
I think the bits that I've read of Andrew Adonis's book about this, the 5 days in May 2010 when the coalition was formed, I find them quite tantalising because Andrew Adonis was part of the Labour team that was taking part in those negotiations. He historically was somebody who was very keen on Lib-Lab coalitions and Lib-Labbery in general. He's been very seared by this experience. He can't stand Nick Clegg. He thinks Nick Clegg is, a Tory in every single way other than in name. And he thinks that Clegg was determined always to do the dirty on any alternative. And so I think he makes that case probably too strongly. I don't think the facts quite support what Andrew Adonis is saying. The interesting thing that Andrew Adonis is saying, to take it a little bit further, is his general scepticism towards a coalition with the Liberal Democrats after 2015. Having been somebody who was keen on coalition, he's now come out and said, I favour single party government. And I think that is very much a Labour thing. And so I think, that's going to be a question we should be probing and discussing much more over the next few months.
Well, let's leave that there for now. There's plenty more on this at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, for the first time in the country's 66 years of independence, there is set to be a democratic transition of power in Pakistan. In a campaign blighted with bomb attacks and threats against secular candidates, voting will take place on Saturday, and the results should be known in the coming days. How momentous an occasion is it? We asked the writer and novelist Camilla Shamsi, who is in Karachi.
The most significant thing about these elections is it's the first time in Pakistan's history that you had a civilian government complete its five-year tenure, and then you're moving into, a transition of power that is peaceful and democratic. So it's never been done before.
And has it felt, from your point of view, like a relatively ordinary democratic election? What's the campaign been like?
There are two very distinct kinds of campaigns. So if you are in the Punjab, which is the largest province and the most powerful province, I think it just feels, like a regular, it's an exciting campaign because it's between Nawaz Sharif's party and Imran Khan's party, which is a bit of a surprise. And the two of them have been campaigning furiously for the last few weeks and, the usual rallies and everything. But if you look at Karachi, where I am, there's almost no campaign activity whatsoever, and that's because the Taliban have threatened three of the big parties. So the PPP, which is the Bhutto party, which are the incumbents, the NQM, which is Karachi's biggest party, and the ANP, which rules in KP, what was formerly known as the frontier region. And the Taliban has basically said they're going to do everything they can to stop these parties from campaigning. So they have been attacking the rallies. There have been almost daily attacks. Candidates have been killed. There have been bombs at election offices. So these parties aren't campaigning at all.
And would you imagine that that sort of intimidation, trying to stop people taking part in the election by the sounds of it, is it likely to swing the result one way or another?
Well, it really has come down to two-horse race between the two parties that are campaigning. And you have different opinions. The PPP really isn't campaigning at all. And Bilawal Bhutto, who is the chairman of the party, who's Benazir's 24-year-old son, isn't in Pakistan and isn't coming back for the elections because of security threats. His father, Zardari, can't campaign because he's the president, so he's constitutionally not allowed to take part in politics. But the word is that the next man down, Amin Fahim, who was asked to lead the campaign, also said he wouldn't because it's too dangerous. So really, there is no PPP campaign whatsoever. And of course, that's going to hurt their electoral chances. No one thinks, even a few weeks ago, no one thought they were going to win. But this total absence of campaigning, the vacuum they've created, which the other parties are able to come into, is obviously going to affect votes. And in the north, because Imran Khan has been campaigning and the ANP, who are the incumbents, haven't, it's quite likely to swing votes his way as well.
How does the power break down between the president and the parliament then?
Well, at the moment, the president, has no role to play in all of this. It's largely a ceremonial role, the presidency. It used to be much more powerful, but it's been, brought back into a more sort of constitutional realm where the president is largely ceremonial. But of course, because he's Asif Zardari, he is a very powerful figure because he has this political backing. But right now, no one's, everyone's concentrating on the different political parties and what the next prime minister is going to be. But then the question will arise, once we're done with elections, the question will arise, what happens when Zardari's term ends? What will be the relationship of the presidency to the prime minister in the time he has left? Will he find a way, because he is a great survivor, will he find a way to extend his term? So these are questions that are going to arise in the next few weeks. But at the moment, everyone's just thinking about Saturday's elections and what's going to happen there.
Okay, and so the overwhelming favourite is Nawaz Sharif, isn't it, who we've heard of before because he has been Prime Minister before. What difference would it make if he were elected?
The big question that always arises in, with civilian governments in Pakistan is how much they're allowed to do when they come to conflict with the army. Nawaz Sharif, as you might recall, in 1999, his government was thrown out by President Musharraf because he was trying to, sort of control the army in some way. So he and the army, who were once close allies, are now very much at loggerheads with each other. The army doesn't like Nawaz Sharif at all. And Nawaz Sharif has come out and said, basically said the army will have to get in line and I'll make the rules. And that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch, whether he's really going to talk up to the army or not. And that's, I think, the main question that people are looking at around Nawaz Sharif.
And what about for relations with the West?
He's one of his campaigning platforms has been that like Imran Khan's party, he opposes the war on terror. But he's, in the last few days, you'll notice that, Imran Khan made a statement saying if he's elected and he takes Pakistan out of the war on terror. Nawaz Sharif's response was sort of, well, hang on, let's not jump the gun here. So he is a pragmatist.
And tell us then about how Imran Khan has been doing this election. Obviously, he's famous here as a cricketer as well as a politician, and it's made the news that he fell off this stage. How's he faring politically?
Well, Imran Khan has been the really interesting story here because 2 or 3 years ago, people have said he doesn't have a hope. In the last year and a half, he's been having these huge rallies. He starts to be seen as a third candidate after the ruling PPP and Nawaz Sharif's PNLM. And just in the last couple of months, there's been a surge, partly because he has been campaigning as opposed to other parties, but also there's a massive youth vote. There are, I think, of the 85 million people on the electoral roll, about 20 million of them are those who've turned 18 since the last election. The youth vote is very much in his favor. Anyone who wants change, sees him as the only figure we haven't already had and been disappointed by. And in sort of 3 weeks ago, people were saying Imran Khan will come second to Nawaz, so they were saying he's going to leapfrog the PPP. When he fell off that stage, when he fell off that platform, he fell 14 feet, hit his head, was carried out bleeding. Everyone was watching that on TV, and there was a massive, massive outpouring of sympathy, affection, respect. I mean, this is a man who at one point was the most popular human being Pakistan has ever produced as a cricket captain. And I think what you're going to see is that because of that you know, fear that everyone had for a few minutes that really it would be a very serious injury, I think a lot of people would have moved over to him. And right now, no one is calling the elections because they're saying that for the sympathy vote, there's no way of telling how that will play out. So right now, what everyone is saying is it depends on the turnout. If voter turnout is lower, so around 50%, then Nawaz stands to gain. If it's much higher, if you have a lot of the youth voters, newer voters coming out, then Imran might just get the majority seat, number of seats. But no one thinks it's going to be enough for a clear majority, and you still need to have a coalition.
The novelist Camilla Shamsi there. Well, that's all we've got time for, so my thanks to Anne Perkins, Martin Kettle and Alan Travis. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks for listening.
Are you an aspiring journalist or writer? The Guardian International Development Journalism Competition is your chance to win an assignment to Africa, Asia or South America. You'll write for The Guardian about the global development issues that face the area you visit. All you need to do is submit a short essay on one of the 12 diverse themes. You can find all the information you need at guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. Enter now to win the work experience of a lifetime. Visit guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. The deadline is midnight on Sunday, the 12th of May. Terms and conditions apply.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.